This is the Farm Assets Conference edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our program today comes from the Farm Assets Conference, held the 15th day of December at the iHotel in Champaign. Our panelists that day on stage included Nick Paulson and Joe Jansen, both agricultural economists from the University of Illinois, along with Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net, Brian Stark from the Andersons, and Colin Waters of the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Nick and Joe laid out what the University of Illinois Farm Doc team sees as the 2024 supply and demand tables and discuss some of the things that producers might and should do going into this very tight next year. We'll pick up at the end of that conversation as Nick Paulson tells the audience that crop insurance is one of the things they really need to continue to consider at high levels in the coming year.
I think those dollars are well spent. The reason you buy insurance is to protect against bad outcomes, and I don't think that's an area to try to cut costs when we're entering the kind of return environment we're going into here. All right, last slide, and then I'll let Todd move on to the panel. Again, perspective here is key. We're looking at a much lower return environment for 23 and 24, but the last few years have just been fantastic income years. And again, just reemphasizing some of the characteristics that we see with more profitable farms consistently through time. I talked about cost control and the power costs and the capital purchases. The other one I would mention is family living. We obviously see that move and vary quite a lot and follow returns very closely. So I think opportunities there for some belt tightening that might be needed moving into next year to kind of alleviate some of the issues that we're facing. Bankers like when I say this. I feel like farmers feel it's kind of the boring approach, but honestly, knowing your financials is key, and knowing your cost of production, and that kind of leads into my last point on marketing. As sexy as kind of focusing on marketing might seem relative to having good financials in place and knowing your cost structure, marketing is just not one of those things that we see associated with consistent success through time. From a profitability standpoint, it's pretty easy to hit a home run on the marketing side in a given year, but it's very hard to consistently do that across time. Being able to be in a position to take advantage of profitable sales opportunities when they occur just becomes that much more important when we're entering into kind of the margin squeeze that we're looking at here for 24. So I'll stop there, Todd.
All right.
Turn it back to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Nick. Anybody got a question for Nick off the top of their head? All right. Nick, hand your mic off. And if you take that mic off, I'm going to take your mic in just a second. If the marketing panel could come up, I would appreciate that. I do have a question, actually, probably on the supply and demand numbers in particular. The $4.70 number, which is higher than USDA's 450. It's also above the long range projection from the Farm Doc team. It's a very high stocks to use stocks in a high stocks to use ratio. Why does that begin with a 4 instead of a 3?
Let me rephrase this and fill in some of the supply and demand figures the Farm Doc team has forecasted for the coming growing season. They expect an 18.3% stocks-to-use ratio, a carryout of 2.649 billion bushels by the time we get to the fall of 2025, or what's left over from the coming corn crop. The season's average cash price at $4.70. That's above what the Farm Doc team has been using as the midpoint, or about 10% in the carryout, which seemed odd to me, and I wanted to know why.
I think the panel might have some opinions on this. I think like inflation is real. The price of everything's going up. So in nominal terms, I mean, part of it is like seeing a $3 number really just kind of like implies a bloodbath in terms of farm profitability, the numbers that Nick put up there. I mean, so I think the price level of everything is up, and that's gonna mean, I think, a corn number with a 4 in front of it.
Is it supported also by the very
tight stocks to use ratio for soybeans? I mean, because we will talk about that as a lift in the marketplace from one commodity to the other, usually as it's related to acreage.
That's right. I think that's the channel, although like just because we have high soybean prices doesn't mean we have to have high corn prices or vice versa. But I think what that means specifically, and again, the point that I would make is where we will go in 24 is very much a function of how we got here. That's one thing that we know about agricultural markets is they don't just sort of like, each year is not a one-off that is unconnected from all the other years. So the fact that we got here from a place where we had, you know, a year ago $7 corn means we're not going to sort of drop down to $3.50 corn.
We'll bring the other three people into the conversation. I talk to them fairly regularly on the radio station. In fact, Matt Bennett, who is parked next to Joe here, I talk every Thursday afternoon with. He's with agmarket.net. Brian Stark happens to be in the center place. Brian, I talk to occasionally on Commodity Week, and he's from here in Champaign County. And then Colin Waters is with us from the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Colin sat in on the Farm Progress Show panels that we held in the tent at Farm Progress Show in Decatur, and is a logistics specialist. Given this year and the water levels in the Mississippi River, I thought it was probably pretty important to bring him back into the conversation. I ask questions to these folks all the time. This is the one where I really want you to raise your hands when you're ready. Just raise your hand and we'll get questions started. I will give each of them maybe 3 minutes to talk a little bit about the marketplace, 3 to 5, Matt, and just lay out what you think the market looks like.
They need to tell me why I'm wrong. That would be.
Oh, he can.
So go for it, guys.
wait.
Fire away.
I think, well, Joe, you're a lot smarter than I am, but I will just say it was very interesting, my balance sheet. I talked with Todd about this a little bit yesterday, actually. My carry is very similar to yours. I think a 181 is a bit aggressive, even though it's well within the realm of possibilities. I'm actually using a little richer acreage. I think 10 million acres from last year, that's going to narrow. There's no question in my mind. And I thought maybe a 90.5 I would go with. But I think cheaper fertilizer might have held on to a few more acres, so I'm actually using 92 currently. But regardless, if Joe's right, if I'm right, and we come up with the 265, my personal opinion is you're going to be dang lucky to get an average cash price of 470. That's my opinion. Okay, so last year, Joe did a fantastic job. I agreed with him and his team. I know it wasn't just you, Joe, but last year, guys, we paid a lot of money. A lot of money to put this corn crop out. And the thing that we have to remember is whenever input costs are really strong, particularly fertilizer, we know what else is typically very high in price, and that's the price of corn, correct? And so I think a lot of people getting fertilizer relief this year feel like, I don't know that I need to be in a big hurry to market anything because my input costs are so much lower. Be careful in those assumptions. I know it's super dry throughout the Corn Belt. I've been all across the country over the last 2 weeks talking. It's a very common theme that it's too dry. But at the same time, guys, you can lock in a worst case scenario, in my opinion, on 24 for corn that looks better than what most folks are going to enjoy for 23 or not enjoy for 23, because we've got way too much wrapped up in a crop that we didn't sell. Okay, so let's be real cautious here. Going into 24.
Brian Stark, a few minutes, please.
I just kind of tag on to what Matt said. It's kind of interesting, you know, looking at Joe's charts on two of the most profitable years that the farmer has had also happen to be some of the higher input cost years. And so now as we've kind of gravitated down, I just did some quick math looking at the projections because I can't argue too much with the 24 acreage. The yield you can debate, but let's just say we shave 6 bushel the acre off of, there we go.
Let me see this one.
We shave 6 bushel off
of that yield and we grow a repeat of 175, you're still looking at a 2 billion bushel carryout. So I think given the lessons we've learned this past year with the farmer being undersold, and whether you can argue it's a third ahead of time that turned it to 25% because yields are really good, it really comes down to revenue gain. You know, I know talking to a lot of growers, both on East Central Illinois and West Central Indiana, the areas that I cover, the yields are really good, sometimes 15 to 20 bushel, better than APH. And in that instance, they were budgeting 550 corn, let's say. If you take the extra bushels and you look at a 490 board, the revenue is basically the same. And I think that's kind of where we've had to kind of go back to the historical revenue game, looking at revenue versus price forecasting to try and look at taking chips off the table from a return. Because we know going forward, things are going to be challenged from a demand standpoint. And when you rely on the domestic factors to drive your balance sheet without a strong export base, we know it's tough sledding. So I guess I'll start with comments there, and then we'll get into your questions here as we go forward.
And finally, Colin Waters from the Illinois Corn Growers Association.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. Colin Waters, I'm the Director of Exports and Logistics at Illinois Corn. I guess I would say that I am pretty optimistic about a rebound in the export program coming up this year. But I guess that's really, when you start at zero, something's better than zero. But I do think there's a lot of headwinds, though, at least, especially in terms of the logistics. For example, the river levels, but there's other problems in Panama. There's geopolitical problems in the Red Sea. Just as an example, Maersk, one of the largest container lines in the world, just hit the pause button on shipping through the Red Sea because the rocket attacks on their container ships. So just being able to move grain around the world is going to be probably an interesting thing going forward. So how that all plays out, I really don't know. But maybe this the wetness in the south of Brazil, the dryness in the Mato Grosso, if that pushes the Safrinha window back, that I have to think that the Brazilians and USDA are probably going to be trimming that number. So it'll be interesting.
How many, raise your hands, how many of you in the audience not have corn set to sell, but year in, every year, sell corn? If you sell corn, raise your hands. Put them up high, leave them up. If you put them up, everybody leave them up. Okay. I'm going to ask questions. It'll be fine. I promise. Leave them up if you sell corn. How many of you sell that corn, some of that corn, usually in the month of December? Usually in the month of December. Was that this year or usually? Ah, interesting. So I want to hear, because we've talked about this on the air a couple of times, but not with Joe, who wrote the article, about when corn is marketed and what this year looks like. Can you recap some of that for me, please?
We're just trying to put together sort of what do we know about farmer selling behavior. Obviously, we know every farm's unique. I have an article out today that sort of describes how farms differ. They are not all the same. We know that that marketing strategies vary a lot across farms. But we look at, there's the thing that I would point out is there's a significant amount of corn to sell once we get to December 31st. USDA marketing weights would say we've got about 60% of the crop to sell on January 1. That's a lot, in my opinion. That's the aggregate number. But part of that is driven by a group of farms that typically have almost everything, almost all of their calendar year production sitting as inventories on their books at year end. There's a slightly bigger group that's marketing, more actively marketing. I think that's a wise decision to be, actively marketing across the entire window in which you can sell grain, which is very long. But there's a group that's not doing that, and that's what sort of Matt was talking about. But there's a bunch of supply that's kind of tied up in the farmers' hands, and the question every year is what does the market take to kind of pull that grain into the supply chain?
So let's talk a little bit about what's on hand. From your perspective at the grain elevator, Brian, are farmers behind?
I would venture to guess, and the answer is yes. In our area, I would say 25% to maybe a third of their production has been sold. What's interesting to me, and I was talking to a grower outside earlier here today, the farmer has looked for any cash needs to move what I would argue is the potentially most friendly commodity, soybeans, right now to generate cash. And I'm not debating on doing that because it's an awful conundrum when your balance sheet could be as tight as $200 million and eventually, if we have some weather issues in South America, bean prices could rally. But if we're borrowing on an operating note at 8% interest, 9 cents a bushel per month is what you would have to earn in cash carry, as well as board appreciation, to offset waiting on soybeans. So it's tough. From a corn perspective, they like to move grain from a timing or seasonality. We're seeing a lot of that, especially in the western part of Indiana into the ethanol plants. And when that's happened, they're not selling the cash. They're not attracted to the cash price. They're using basis contracts, or maybe it's some form of free DP. And I think that long term of, excuse me for saying this, kicking the can down the road acts as a wet blanket over the top of the market, that any type of rally we may get will act as a lid to prevent us from moving much higher than maybe some of the targets that we have to want to achieve. So I think there's a long way to go on the corn front from a sales standpoint.
Can I have you, Colin, go through the set of slides that you brought with us about logistics, and because we've mentioned these things already. So.
Sure. Yeah, and I can, I basically brought these just as backups, so if
I think you can run through them fairly quickly, yeah, but they'll be important and inform the rest of our conversation.
It should be pretty quick. So anyways, I guess what I wanted to illustrate here is that even, things are improving on the river system, but it's not ideal by any stretch, right? So things have improved. This is at Memphis, but around St. Louis, it's a little bit worse. But you can see that there's a projection for some more water in the system, but then that basically declines immediately. And then in the longer term forecast, we see that it's just dry in the entire Mississippi system. And remember that a majority of the water on below St. Louis is from the Ohio. So the Ohio River Valley is projected to be really dry in the next few weeks. This is an illustration of the shipping lanes around the world, and I think it's a good way to kind of visualize how things move. And obviously the Gulf position for us is most important, and generally what happens is we load vessels in New Orleans, they pass through the Panama Canal and make their way over to Asia. Those are really some of the top markets outside of Mexico. And recently, the rains in Panama just haven't materialized. So this is the worst drought that they've experienced in something like 50 years, maybe it's been 60 years now. And I think a lot of people kind of assume that, well, I mean, it's a canal, right? But why? How could rainwater disrupt a canal? Well, it's a lock and dam system, and it's all fresh water. So instead of cutting a channel all the way across the isthmus, basically what the engineers did is they dammed up a couple rivers, created some massive reservoirs to float boats on, and then did some cutting here and there through the jungles. And so those reservoir levels are down, and they're down to a point where it's becoming a problem. So just as kind of a reset, or I guess a baseline, these are the sales, the announced export sales for the current marketing year. You can see that Mexico is obviously our top market, but the Asian markets are really significant, especially in Japan. Hopefully the Chinese will be picking up the pace a little bit more. But all of those markets are traditionally served through the canal. And so if it basically what's happening now is the wait time on the canal, this is kind of hard to see, but it's roughly 7 days right now. That's improved slightly over the last couple weeks, but we're coming into the dry season in Panama, so it could potentially get worse. And so the longer, time is money for these vessels, so they need to be moving. And if they're just sitting and they can't get a slot, they got to go somewhere else. They got to try a different way. And right now, slots are pretty much booked. They're holding auctions for additional slots, but those are running between $2 and $4 million per vessel. So that's a $25 to $50 per ton, charge for grain, and that really isn't realistic. If you're moving a container vessel or you're moving, natural gas or something like that, some higher value product, then that would make sense. But in the grain system, it doesn't really work. So this is just an example of where the river, or I'm sorry, the reservoir levels are, and we're approaching kind of that minimum in Panama, and approaching the lowest on record. It's approaching that. I'll back up. And so I guess the other thing, just because this happened today, I'll try to back up as best I can here. But so instead of going through the Panama Canal, the alternatives, you basically got two. You could go through the Suez Canal. So you go into the Mediterranean, you go through the Suez in Egypt, and you exit out by Yemen. Exit the Red Sea, and that's basically the Bab al-Mandab is where the rebels have been firing rockets at ships, and so that is maybe not really much of an option now. So then the other option is to go around the Cape of Good Hope, so the go around South Africa. That adds it's around 20 extra days to that voyage, and that's 20 extra days of cost. So it's just it makes it a lot more expensive to move from the Gulf or the East Coast to Asia. So I don't know. We're as optimistic as I am for a good crop and a good export program. There definitely are some headwinds. And then this is the last thing that I'll leave you with is that we're at Illinois Corn. We're interested in moving a lot of grain, obviously. That's important for farmers, but we're also interested in exporting distillers' grains, ethanol, all the meat products that, the animals that consume corn. So you can see over time that blue shaded areas are the corn grain exports. And so, I mean, if you kind of draw a line across, they're fairly flat, to be honest. I mean, there's maybe a slight uptrend, but the bulk of the increase in corn bushel equivalent exports has been from other stuff. And so that's why, at least at Illinois Corn and the Checkoff, we're investing in things like the U.S. Meat Export Federation, the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council, U.S. Grains Council, and kind of coming back to one of the things that was talked about earlier is the MAP and FMD programs. Those are the USDA programs that help develop foreign markets, and those dollars are matched by checkoff dollars. So it's farmer-led, farmer investment that's supported with USDA. So those are really critically important.
So I want to bring this, Brian, to you. Given your experience within the cash market, so we talked about the Panama Canal backing up, costing more money. I had a discussion with Frayne Olson, North Dakota State University Extension Specialist, on Monday of this week about the same kinds of problems. He was concerned about the backup because of, potentially, of a backup on the lower Mississippi River should there be a call for exports, the pace increasing, not demand increasing, but just the call for current demand, and that basis might not look very good in that case, despite the fact that corn would be trying to move, that it just would have to find an alternate route that would be more expensive. What are your thoughts?
No, I think that's probably right. I think, you know, one of the things from a basis or cash perspective, not only are we trying to navigate a lower range of futures prices, we're set in a market where we haven't really traded a good carry, where those that have on-farm storage really get paid for their space. The last 4 or 5 years, we've dealt with tight supply, strong demand, inverted markets where your space basically punished you or you didn't earn anything on it. Today, we've kind of had to go back to normal where basis may not be as strong as we've seen. Certainly seasonality or in instances where there may be, I guess, a supply or a lack of where from point A to point B, where you'd have to spend more, where basis would come under pressure down the river in spots where it's not creating demand. But just from a standpoint of normalized basis, which is, you know, 15 under the respective. I mean, I remember back in when we had a last carry year, we've had to deal with that. So it's kind of realigning those basis targets. And not only that, but selling the cash carry, you know, selling out against your some of your deferred months. What do I mean by that? When you have a large carry out year and you have a spot month that comes under pressure and finds equilibrium before the futures market finishes trading and delivery. Use December futures as an example. 470, just arbitrarily picking a number. Typically what tends to happen when demand is kind of flat and there's a lot of excess supply is that the next month, March, gravitates as it enters delivery to that same point. May, July do the same thing. So while the market is paying us a carry, both in maybe the cash basis and the board, we have to sell against that carry to capture it, or we risk losing that over the course of time.
What considerations are you thinking about, Matt, as it relates to the crop that has yet to be marketed for both corn and soybeans?
If it's in the bin at home, I would sell the carry in the market. I would sell July corn and do what the elevator does, wait on the basis to come to you. You're going to lock yourself in $5 basis the board. I know some of you are saying, well, that's not, you know, I mean, I've heard all through the 23 crop year that I can't sell at whatever price because I can't make money. I got news for you. You may not make money on the 23 crop. I mean, it's not pleasant to think about on corn. All right. Now, most of us, if you look at your soybean situation, it's probably a little bit better. Okay, you probably find a little more black ink. The problem with corn, of course, is that, you know, we put a really expensive crop in the ground and didn't sell any $6 corn, unfortunately, as a general rule, okay? And so I think that my personal thought, if it's a home, I'm going to hedge a decent amount of it, hedge it out to the July, and then wait and see what happens with basis. As far as soybeans are concerned, yes, there's the potential we could get into a rally situation. If Brazil turns off, or not turns off, if Brazil doesn't get the rain that a lot of people are trying to put in for the last half of December on further out, you know, there's no question that you could see this bean market get pretty warm, pretty hot, if you will. But at the same time, you know, we've seen much better prices than what we already have today. So you got to ask yourself, at what point am I actually going to sell? You know, because we've already seen $14 come and go. And I'm not trying to be cute. I'm just saying that, like, put offers in. Let's put offers in place. Force yourself and don't pull them. Put offers in place and allow them to execute if we do get that type of rally. And if we don't, you have to also tell yourself that if Brazil turns off wet, what's that going to do to the market, you know? And so one thing, I mean, Joe's right. You could be looking at a very tight situation domestically. You're not looking at a tight situation worldwide unless Brazil has issues, though. And so you've got to understand those are diverging dynamics, whereas for corn, it's a bearish situation from a world balance sheet standpoint. It's bearish for the U.S. balance sheet situation. That's clear. And so, you know, I don't want to be super, super bearish, Todd. I just want to be realistic. And I think last year, the realism that Joe brought to the table, I hope people listen to it, but based upon elevator guys like Brian that I've talked to, I don't know that enough of us did listen to it. And so, you know, don't get disillusioned once again by the fact that input prices are lower this year, so you've got time to sit on your hands and do nothing.
Who's got questions they want answered? Ryan?
Question for you. In the past, it's been, there are several months that you would get highs. You'd have a better opportunity to sell. June's one. Bad month is February, usually. Have we changed that dynamic with Brazil taking over the lead in the world for corn and soybeans? And have we changed that dynamic enough that it's going to matter that all our history back to that? I mean, when you said December might be a really good, you know, did you sell for whatever reason? But maybe in the future, what Brazil does in November, October, November, December, January matters more than our old wait till June 21st and you made money?
So I think that's that seasonal rally in June for new crop is still a thing. We saw it last year, and I think that weather concerns in the U.S. will continue to drive that as a seasonal selling opportunity that does not make money every year, but is something you need to think about on new crop. I do think on old crop, like once we get into that old crop situation, like where we are now, the situation in South America changes things, and we are still kind of feeling out what is the long run balance between the US and South America in terms of corn supply and demand into this January, February, March period. And I think you guys can kind of,
you know, I think as you become more of a global marketplace like we are, I mean, it changes a lot of your seasonalities. Okay, so one thing that I always try to encourage my producers to think about is let's not look at, well, you know, 3 years in a row I sold in May and it, you know, right? Well, then the fourth year, it's the low of the year, right? It just happens that way. And so if I'm basing my sales program on profit margins, return on investment, then that's more of a take the emotion out of it type dynamic. One thing that I would also encourage us to do, you know, as far as South America is concerned, is as they continue to grow more soybeans than we do, a drought here doesn't mean what it used to mean, but a drought there actually is a Christmas gift. You know, so let's say that they do have Brazil stays dry. If they do, guys, we need to understand we've done nothing to earn whatever rally we end up getting, and take advantage of it, please.
There's a fairly big disconnect between your presented outlook here on 2020 or 24-25 prices and what March 25 futures are right now. I'm wondering what, I'm not questioning that, I'm just saying, asking what strategies would you use to take advantage of those higher, we actually have new crop futures higher than old crop right now.
I think you want to be proactively marketing in this spring period, sorry, in sort of January through June, some portion, and that's not a big number, that's like less than a quarter, but a significant, a non-trivial portion of that new crop corn, either for delivery at harvest or later on in the marketing year. But I think, yeah, there's nothing wrong with selling grain in the same year that you produced it.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I've heard from a lot of producers, like this week I was in Iowa and I spoke in two places that were 4 hours apart and everybody's just scared to death because it's dry. I don't want to sell anything, right? And so I ask, one thing I always ask people, do you buy crop insurance? You know, if you buy crop insurance, you have insured bushels, okay? And so as Joe's suggesting, you know, if you can lock in profit margins on these early sales, what I always say is if your first sale is your worst sale, but it's profitable, you're going to have a darn good year. And so if I'm buying my crop insurance, I've got to think my way through, what can I do with those insured bushels? We've been even a little more aggressive than what Joe's said, you know, in some cases. And the reason is because we're locking in profit margins, but we're doing so with a flexible strategy. So I fully expect and would hope that producers would understand this marketing window is so large. But it's changed, as Brian said. This is a carry environment that we're in. I mean, this is different than what we've been in. And so you're going to have to market differently than what you have the last few years, or think about it differently at least.
The next question was off mic, but it was about using min-max option strategies.
I like those. I think that when you have what I would call like a risk versus reward strategy, always keep in mind that you'll latch onto the reward if you want, maybe even manage the risk. You can even accentuate those strategies sometimes. You know, just from a simplistic standpoint, what if a person bought like a May short-dated $5 put option, you know, and maybe sold a 580 call to pay for it. If the market goes to 580 and you've got to true some of your bushels up to 580, given your input costs, that's a darn good year. So there's a lot of different ways to tackle this, but that's just one of them I'm throwing out.
Usually, you know, in the February period of time when crop insurance or spring prices are set, there's usually some kind of coinciding bid for acreage. Do you think that the world carryover will overshadow the narrow carryover you have here for soybeans at 7.3?
Go ahead. Yeah. I think it's very similar to what we were talking about before. I think, you know, you're entering a stage on the world now where the South American crop arguably could mean more than what we raise domestically. So the answer is yes. I also think that, you know, we've got kind of a coincide of the early bean crop starting to harvest at late January down in Brazil and then extending to the full season crop through the month of February, they kind of align. So it's kind of hard to kind of see the forest through the trees, so to speak, because you're talking about acreage, we're talking about a crop production issue in South America potentially. But I do agree that that could overshadow the tightness because the U.S. is not the world leader in soybean exports anymore.
You know, what if it's a hot potato type acreage discussion this year too? I mean, I don't know. Like, what if one market moves lower and the other one decides it's got to move lower too? I hope that's not what happens, but with world stocks where they're at, that's a possibility.
My question is, you know, as I hear you talk, it seems like you're kind of focused on corn on these forward sales, you know, where everything's at. And given the corn-soybean ratio where it's at, maybe we pull more soybean acres. Do you think producers ought to be as aggressive in forward selling beans as they are corn, or what's the panel's thoughts? I haven't heard much about forward sales of beans at this point.
I think on the bean front, it holds true the same. We've been focused, you're right, a lot on corn, but I think more specifically, at least in my mind, the conundrum's on old crop beans where the balance sheet's tight. If we believe that we're going to plant, or the market's going to encourage us to plant an extra 5 million acres of soybeans, then again, going back to the carry discussion I mentioned earlier, selling ahead and locking in some profitable margins is appropriate. I mean, I like Matt's philosophy. When growers ask me, you know, what percent should I be sold ahead? Should I sell ahead? What's the target? It really starts with crop insurance and what's your base policy. And the first thing then we're going to do before we get to the month of February and know our price is we're going to look at profitable levels that take care of our deductible, whether that's 10% or 15%, depending on if you have an enhanced policy coverage. So I think selling beans ahead, if you get over $13, I like the flexible strategies similar to what Matt recommended. I'm not, in this environment, even though we're kind of in a sell and defend type environment, I still like being flexible versus static. And what I mean by that is just selling, making a sale and forgetting about it. So I think using options and some sort of floor ceiling strategy makes a lot of sense.
I totally agree. And it's a good question, by the way. We've been fairly aggressive on soybeans as well, okay? And part of the reason for that is that, you know, we've had multiple opportunities at over $13 beans for 24. And I'm sitting here looking at this, and you look at what you're putting into the bean crop as well. Obviously, you've got some relief there too. It's not near as sizable as corn for most of the producers we talk to. But how many years would we have given our right arm for $11 beans or $10 beans, you know, and we're sitting here, well, 13's not enough. You know, let's be honest. How many of us have said I sold cash beans 2 years ago for $16, right? And I'm like, big freaking deal. What's that got to do with 24 beans? Nothing. Let's lock some of it in. I mean, I don't know. I think locking in a worst case scenario when times are profitable, you're very rarely going to be frustrated that you did that, in my opinion.
Just to add on old crop, if you're talking about old crop beans, I mean, the market's paying you next to nothing right now to store those beans. So I think you have to be really serious about thinking about, you've got the upside covered with 24.
The farmer's always long.
Farmer is always long.
And so if like Brian said, 9 cents a bushel to hold onto those beans, that's in your bin at home. So if you're paying commercial storage, and then I wanted to say something about free DP, Brian. There's nothing free about free DP.
That's right.
Sorry.
No. I agree 100%.
You had mentioned the missile attacks in the Suez Canal. Could there eventually be a competitive advantage for the United States being able to provide better protection for our own cargo ships versus other countries?
Well, so it's kind of interesting. So, I don't know. could be totally boring. But so all the attacks that are happening right now are coming from Yemen, and so it's at the south end of the Red Sea. So it's not in the Suez in Egypt, but they're apparently targeting ships that have are either destined for Israel or something like that. I guess I'm not really sure, but I believe that there's five different countries have bases in Djibouti. So that's across the strait from Yemen. So really almost within, a missile range of Yemen, right? So it's US, France, I think China's got a new base there. There's a couple more. So there is a military presence there. And so it, on some level, it's a little bit surprising to me that they've been so aggressive. I don't know that there would be much of a competitive advantage for U.S. Vessels. On some level, this is like a Plan C or Plan D effort for a lot of these shippers just to get something moving. Ideally, it's going to rain in Panama, and everything's back to normal for us. So, I don't know. I don't know that it answered the question appropriately, but maybe halfway.
Can I turn the question the other way? How much of a disadvantage is it for the United States by comparison to Brazil, Argentina, when the Panama Canal is in the shape it is?
Yeah, I think it's a. I don't have the numbers, off the top of my head, but it is fairly significant. The increased cost. It's not like, going through the Panama Canal is free or anything. There's fees that are associated with that, but it's a much shorter voyage from the Gulf over to those Asian markets. The Brazilians that'll be shipping basically across the Indian Ocean, anyways, they'll be okay, absent any sort of trouble in the Malacca Straits, and further on the other side of the Indian Ocean. So, yeah, it's this is potentially problematic for a while, too. And it's something that I don't know that it really hasn't been in the press all that much. We haven't really been talking about it a lot. But, yeah, it's an issue.
Let's wrap it up. We'll get a final word from each of you. I think, Matt, we'll start with you, and then we'll work this way and let Joe.
The first thing I want to say is it's interesting that our FOB values for both corn and beans right now are cheaper than Brazil by a fair margin, which with logistics, it's interesting to me. Yeah. But final word for me, I guess, is that I could see us here a year from now saying, that we wish we would have maybe been aggressive again. I'm worried about, we came off this high. The beauty of the whole thing is that we made a lot of money in 21 and 22, thank goodness. So we've got some money in our pocket. But if we learn from the past, what did it look like, for instance, after 12, in 13, we kept scaling back. 15 through 19 were zero fun. And we are set up for that sort of an environment if Brazil has a normal crop. And if we plant 92 million acres of corn or 91 million acres of corn, with what our hybrids are capable of, I'm very concerned about what profit margins might look like. So I do want to be somewhat aggressive in latching onto these. I want to be flexible, like Brian said, and I want to make sure that I'm using my crop insurance, also as Brian said, as a part of my marketing plan, because I think that, you're going to sleep a heck of a lot better at night if you manage some risk up front.
Brian?
I will add ditto to what Matt just said, but I'd also add one of my favorite phrases, hope is not a trading strategy. Please don't forget that. And I think we're in an environment now where we have to get sharp with our pencil. We have to sell and defend, like Matt just said, and we have to realign into a different type of market than most of us haven't seen in 4 or 5 years with the carry market structure, which, by the way, if we do a good job selling ahead and locking in margin, we're going to be rewarded, especially if you have on-farm storage, all right? And especially for the grower that doesn't have on-farm storage, it's imperative to manage the risk, because the bushels you deliver to the elevator in the fall are your highest risk bushels. So be ready to make sales, use offers, be flexible in your strategies. I think that's pretty much where I would focus moving ahead to 24.
Yeah, I guess, obviously I'm not the market analyst, so please don't rely on me for any sort of market advice. But what I would say is that I'll be paying really close attention to what's happening in South America, not only weather-wise and just planting progress-wise in Brazil, but also politically in Argentina, because the last time they had a real major reform in their grains export tax framework, they basically increased wheat production by something like 50%, and that could, I mean, we haven't talked any about wheat, but that that could have a disrupting effect on the world market right now. And then I guess the only other thing I might mention is, even though I focus on exports, one thing that we haven't really talked about either this morning or yet is the ethanol market. And I think we're going into this, like Scott had said, there's a 5 to 10 year window before kind of sustainable aviation fuel really begins in earnest. But we're looking at some regulations and rules that are coming down right now that are have the potential to really crimp ethanol demand in the U.S. So for a sector that consumes about a third of the corn crop, it's something that you all need to be paying attention to. And as electric vehicles become more prominent, and vehicles are becoming more and more efficient, the demand for liquid fuels, if the status quo remains the same, is just going to keep diminishing. So I think that that in between now and the 5 to 10 year period where SAF really expands, it should be something that we're all paying attention to, I think.
I think just to close things up, I echo back to what Nick had talked about where margins might be. I think that's the long run state of these markets, is we drive price levels and the economics of farming back to that sort of zero economic profit condition where we're just covering those cash rents. We have to be prepared to live in an environment like that for some period of time in the next few years at some point. So hopefully don't make that, it's less fun, but don't make it a zero fun. Done. How about that?
He thinks it's zero fun.
I was just wondering if you guys had a bar set up out
there. No, we do not have a bar set up out there. Give these guys a nice round of applause. Thank you.
You've been listening to an excerpt of the marketing panel that was presented during the 2023 Farm Assets Conference at the iHotel in Champaign. Our panelists included Joe Jansen, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, Brian Stark of the Andersons, Colin Waters of the Illinois Corn Growers Association, and Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.